Your city's a sucker. Your city's a sucker. Your city's a sucker. My city's a creep.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. So glad to be with you for another week of Chicago Film Talk. Connor, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Tom. You know, ever since I read the first couple Harry Potter books, I've always had an obsession with, like the Tom Marvolo Riddle, Lord Voldemort twist.
Anagram?
At the end of
is that what it is?
At the
anagram?
End of the second one? Yeah, I've been kind of obsessed with anagrams. So while I was hanging out the other day, I decided to do that with No Coast Cinema.
Okay.
See if there were anything that I could spell out with No Coast Cinema, and I found that you, in fact, cannot spell No Coast Cinema without a Tom and a Con, and then nice. And then there's also an S in there somewhere, but that's okay.
A Tom, but you need...
A Tom, a Con, and nice. And that's fucking incredible. I think.
Well, it's certainly serendipity. Is that serendipitous?
Yeah. It's as if fate has like pushed us into this comfy little studio.
Into this potential merchandising...
gold mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of fate, we have a fantastic guest for you today.
Yeah, that is true. We got a guy that I met quite a while ago, and we talked about having him on the show, and then there was this dead zone. We went to the Stephen King dead zone while he was off. I was off doing nothing, and he was off, you know, being in a massive, successful Showtime series.
Yep.
As you do.
Yeah, right.
And
well, that's what happens.
That's what happens when you have these great guests from the city of Chicago. Everybody's always off doing something really interesting, and we're just kind of like sitting twiddling our thumbs like, well, maybe we could talk about
You do what you know.
Yeah, exactly. But today we welcome Mr. Mickey O'Sullivan, actor from the city of Chicago, and he is a fantastic actor. He's been in a lot of interesting stuff recently, had a few appearances in series taking place here in Chicago. He was in Chicago PD, he was in All Points Bulletin, and now he is currently in Showtime's The Chi, created by Lena Waithe, who you may know from Master of None on Netflix.
Right.
She writes, and she also helps star in that show as well, but this is her show called The Chi, about growing up on the south side of Chicago, and Mr. Mickey O'Sullivan is part of that program as Chef Dan. And which I'm excited to see where this goes.
Yeah.
Does he cook? What does Chef Dan cook?
It better be Chicago food. Is it, Mickey? Give him a chance
Serious Chicago Asian fusion.
Oh, great.
Food. Yeah.
Well, that's about as serious as it gets.
If there's one thing I know about Chicago, it's known
Asian
for
food.
Yeah, it's Asian fusion food.
Well, I will say this. One of my friends has said this before, and I think it's true. Chicago's the food capital of the world.
Oh, yeah. If you want a heart attack, you're coming to Chicago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to come and die here for the food.
And you can die from grease. Yeah. You can die from salt. Mm-hmm. Celery salt? There's no end to it.
Varieties of salt.
Well, thank
you so much for coming on the show, Mickey. We really appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. It's been a year?
Something
like
that.
It's like Veterans Day or Memorial Day or one of those two. I always get them confused. Terrible.
Yeah. It was 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. That's when I worked best.
I want to say Memorial Day. Yeah. And we were in this exact studio, in fact, and I was sitting behind the producer booth and listening to you guys talk, and it was just, you were commanding the room.
At 3 a.m.
At 3 a.m.
No easy feat.
No, exactly. And
like
it was
that's when I work best, you know.
Bingo. So let's jump into it. You are born in New York City, but raised here in Chicago.
Totally, yeah. So born in New York City with my mom and my dad, both had my brother out there about a year and some change before that. And then they split up. When I was like 2 and a half, but I had just enough time to work on a soap opera out there as a baby, like in a diaper, you know. My brother got recommended to do like commercials and stuff, and so he went to this audition and for As the World Turns, and he started crying as soon as he went up on the stage, and so my mom went to go grab him and take care of him, and I disappeared in my little diaper and walked up on the stage. And I don't know if the casting directors or producers were just exhausted, tired, but I was super happy there. And they're like, yeah, that kid, that's great, cool.
That's really? What it's, yeah. Works for me. I like the way he, you know, he has a certain something about him. That's a good baby.
Dry-eyedness about him on the stage.
I can't hear him. It's great. Yeah.
So you appeared in a season of As the World Turns. What was your character?
I was Baby Adam. And
that was the name of the character?
That was the name of the character. I've been trying, like, if anybody out there has access to, like, records of my name. I have no idea what my name was back then, like my stage name or whatever. So I've been looking all over for, like, you know, a season. I know my dad had it, but I think he lost it. You know, it's typical dad stuff. You know?
Taped over it with the Bears game.
Yeah, so it's stupid. That he would never watch, you know? And so I did that, and then my parents split up, and thank God for everybody. You know, like, some people just shouldn't, are better people opposites, you know, like, sure. When they're not together. And so my mom came back to Chicago to live with her family. Her family is from Chicago. And grew up here, you know, playing hockey and getting in trouble, and then trying not to get in trouble, and then finding theater, and
yeah.
Been everywhere since, like, yeah, New York, LA, Minnesota, New Jersey. I've been all over the place, and Chicago's the only place that you can sit down and smile knowing that you're about to get a heart attack.
Right,
at
yeah.
Your plate.
Well, I mean, with despite being born in New York City, I mean, Chicago's your home.
Yeah.
I mean, really, no you doubt. Were raised here. Yeah. Tell us about growing up in Chicago. What's, you know, some yeah. people, for us, for Connor and I, we're from the suburbs. And granted, we know a little bit about the Chicago experience, but it's always from the outside looking in. So tell us about growing up here.
I'm a little bit closer. So I grew up for the early parts near Midway Airport, mm-hmm. Like Harlem and Archer. It's right by, like, the Fleetwood roller rink, one of the few roller rinks still commanding mm-hmm. some presence in the town.
Still?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's still up and rolling. So I'm dying to get back there and put on some roller skates and fall
show
my ass,
what
you
for.
Know. I went to St. Daniel the Prophet down there, and I remember, like, thinking that public school kids were, like, yeah, troublemakers, and, like, we had all these stories. Like, we'd walk past the school and be like, "I heard Tommy got stabbed last week."
Oh my god!
But then, like, my brother, we had. You know, a little bit of a tiff with the Catholic Church, as most people do. yeah. And I was crying one day as a baby, and so my mom went to go take me from the center, you know, procession or whatever, into the crying room. They actually have a crying room.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's how you know your church is not doing so well, right. Or, you know, really including one of the two, maybe both. She went to go bring me back there, and the priest started making this, like, this comment about how, like, you choose to walk away from the church, and you choose, and, like, all of this awful stuff. My mom's, like, single mom, busting her ass 24/7, you know, just trying to give us a good life. And I remember at that point, like, she stopped being, you know, a member of that church. And, like, soon after, you know, we moved to Oak Lawn, Illinois, and we never really looked back, you know, like, you can find faith in whatever ways you want to,
sure.
But we never really looked back onto that side of things. But we still had my grandfather over near that area, and we grew up in an area where it was, like, kind of in the city. Mm-hmm. Like, going back there as a kid making trouble, I remember getting jumped down there. And, you know, and, like, we're talking about the bad things here, but, like, sure. There are so many great things. Like, there was Valley Forge Park over there, and, like, we were always running around. I just remember the other day I ran away from home when I was a kid. Do you remember doing that?
Oh, yeah.
I never got very far.
Yeah, yeah. You never get far. Like, where'd you go?
Because even though you've been down every road in your hometown, all of a sudden you completely forget where you are. So you mentioned growing up in Chicago, getting into trouble.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, what was acting your saving grace, or were you just going to be...
That was a long game, saving grace. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, so, like...
What drove you into the arms of the acting community?
So I played hockey, and that was to get out of, like, I was hanging out with some people who were, you know, stealing bikes, getting into fights, stealing shit. Somebody stole something from my house, from my brother, one of my friends, and that was, like, the end.
Sure.
You know, my mom and my brother both sat me down and, like, what are you doing? You know, you're better than this. And so my mom was like, what can I do? You know, like, what can I do to, like, give you some sort of, and I was going through, like, weight problems and stuff, and my brother was skinny. Popular, you know, like, intelligent, and I was the kid, like, you know, walking home from school singing songs to myself and making up, like, scenes in my head. And I had played hockey when I was very young. My uncle John got me into it. He was like my dad figure. And I was like, you know, I know we can't afford it, so I can't ask. And I was like, but I want to play hockey. And so she was like, well, if you can work really hard at this and get a college scholarship, you know, like, that's a totally worthy investment. And so she threw everything she could into, you know, finding 20-odd jobs and making sure that we can afford it. Because hockey's like, I can't even begin
it's
to tell
like
you
like prohibitively expensive at
right.
times.
It is, you know, yeah, disgusting.
Yeah.
You know, even like now I'm like, ah, maybe I'll get some new skates. And I go online, it's like $600. And I'm like, yeah. Maybe not. Where's the lost and found?
Yeah. Just hit up the Blackhawks. It's like, do you guys do used sales? Anything like that?
I just picked up a shinny set. I don't know. You guys know what shinny hockey is?
No.
It's like little nets and little sticks. And like, you know, that's what I grew up playing. I remember playing in the
like
tournament
in
Columbus.
Is it like played in the gym?
Yeah.
Okay.
But smaller.
Do you smaller. Do you remember gym when that used to, it was like the four-way hockey?
Yeah, yeah.
It was kind of like that, it sounds like shinny hockey, except everybody.
Like
it's
downsized.
Like four different teams. And you kind of find out in who in your class is an asshole and who isn't.
I was the asshole.
Oh,
I was way too competitive. My poor gym teacher.
It's kind of a bizarre thing how sports can teach you a lot about who you are.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Totally.
I was a swimmer, so I found out way too late after 10 years of swimming that I hated swimming.
Did you shave your head?
I did.
The whole body?
Yeah, I did.
Damn.
Yeah.
I got a lot of respect for you.
Yeah. Thank you.
I did that later, but it was like a breakdown, you know what I mean?
That was more of a what does it all mean sort of shave.
Yeah,
you know?
It wasn't
Britney Spears, you know?
Hey, man, if, you know,
whatever
if Britney Spears can get through 2007,
hell yeah.
I think we can get through anything.
Hell
That's
yeah.
That's true.
So when you started acting, was it just like through school? Did you seek it out elsewhere?
I blew up my knee, yeah, playing hockey. I was actually playing basketball in gym because I was that asshole who took it too seriously. You know what I mean? I hate basketball too.
You were just like hate trying?
I don't know. Like, I was in gym class and I felt like I needed to keep my conditioning up, right? Like, that was my only chance during the day.
Sure.
I remember like foregoing study hall to go in the gym and just sit on a bike for like 2 hours because I played hockey so late. Most of those guys were playing since they were two or three. Mm-hmm. You know, a good friend of mine is playing in the Olympics right now, Go Kendall Coyne. She's on the U.S. women's team. And they've been playing since they were super young. And my thought was, I just need to be in better shape, try harder. And, you know, like, it wasn't easy for me to play hockey. You know, it wasn't something that came naturally to me. And so when I got injured, I just started getting in trouble again. I was sitting around, I was smoking a lot of pot and, you know, like, playing a lot of Mario. You know, I had like a revelation playing Mario. I took shrooms in high school, which was actually a great experience. But I was playing Mario and, you know, God was talking to me through Mario. It was great, right? And I watched the Sopranos episode. You remember the one where Tony Soprano is in the coma?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when I watched, right? And there's a
Grey's Anatomy. While playing Mario?
No, this was afterwards.
Oh, okay.
Right? No.
After a Mario sesh.
Yeah.
Totally. Just like, let's go watch the Sopranos.
God Mario.
On shrooms.
I knew people were going to be coming home, so I was like, I need to calm down and stop talking to God through Mario because that's going to be a telltale sign that I'm on a hallucinogen.
Sure.
And so I turned on the TV and Grey's Anatomy was on, and it was the episode where two people were connected by a train pole, like there was a train accident.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had to like choose who was going to live and who was going to die, because as soon as they pulled the pole or people off the pole, you know, one of them was going to die. It was just the way it was going to be. And so I'm like bawling my eyes out. And then Tony Soprano comes on. And it's this like, you know, White House in the middle of the woods while he's in his coma. And then he starts hearing things in the hospital room. And I'm like, I need to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Go to sleep. But so at that point, I had a lot of free time. You know, like I was used to waking up at 5 a.m., working out, going to the rink, going to school. I moved away from home and then going straight to the rink after that and spending most of my weekends playing hockey. And I had all of this time and a lot of energy now. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do anything because of my leg. And my high school drama teacher, Tom Zerzan, brought me in and was like, so there's this musical called Beauty and the Beast. Have you heard of it? We'd love for you to be in it. And I did it. And I did men's choir that year as an elective because I was like, I don't know, I'm singing all those songs to myself every time I'm on the, you know, route from one place to the next. So why not do it? And that was my saving grace for sure. Yeah.
So I got to ask, in Beauty and the Beast, what was your role? I have to know.
Baby?
Baby. townsperson number one, town crier. No, I was the Monsieur DRK. I was the guy who ran the mental institution.
Okay.
Yeah. And they taught me everything I needed to know because they were like, so here's your costume. And I was like, and he's an old guy who is kind of creepy, so I'm going to use cobwebs for my hair. Right, and they're gonna be little spiders in there, and but I think it was all because I couldn't really sing and I couldn't really dance, and so I was just coming up with ways to make the character more interesting, and you know my high school theater director was like, you don't have rhythm either, so we got to keep rhythm, and so he had this stupid dance that he choreographed that my mom still gives me shit about to this day, like wagging my hips from side to side. Just did it for, we got a kid in my life, a 6-year-old kid named Jackson. And I was like, you know, a long time ago, I did this thing and you got to see this kid. Yeah. And he was like, oh, geez.
Did it come naturally to you? Did you feel that stepping into the acting was just right?
Yeah, that was the easiest thing that I've ever, it was the easiest choice I've ever made, right? It was like, it made it for me. Right before I did that, I did, we did chorus, right, or choir, and I was selected to do the high part in Ba-Ba-Ba-Baran. You know, Ba-Baran.
Yeah.
And we're not going to do it now because my voice has changed immensely since then. But my mom was like, Mick, you should have seen it. Like, it was as if you had found the thing that you were made to do. You know, the whole crowd just went wild. It was like, you know, she was like, it was like Elvis walked into the room. And I'm looking for the tape because I sincerely don't believe that. but, you know, I did it. And it didn't take hockey kind of trying, you know, like hockey was like you try out for 40 teams and maybe two of them express interest.
Sure.
And for this, it was like everybody expressed interest in giving me opportunities. And so I just kind of ran with it. Went to school at Illinois State to do theater, but I also felt like, you know, this was a new thing and I made a decision during a traumatic moment. You know, they say like you have a traumatic moment in your life, don't make a major life decision in the next 6 months. Well, I did. So I also had like a backup plan. I was really interested in being a special ed teacher. And so I went to school for special ed as well. And in the first year I realized you can't do both.
No.
You know, one of them is going to, if you give a crap,
right,
you got to give your time mm-hmm. and your energy. And so acting was, I don't know, it was a very easy choice for me.
And what was it like going from something that you had to try super hard to be like satisfied with, you know, hockey? It sounds like you had to really work your body and kind of get the routine down, waking up at 5 and everything. What was it like going from something like that where you had to put a lot of effort into it to something that came effortlessly to you?
Sure. Kind of a sense of unease, you know, like it shouldn't be this easy. It's like when you're sitting there like, what am I forgetting? And so I think that kind of led to me applying the same practices, right? So like if I could do this without much effort, how good would I be able to be if I put in effort and if I really tried and I really gave the same thing that I gave to hockey to this? And so that led, I still have a lot of confidence issues, right? Like, because I still feel like I got into it pretty late, you know?
Sure.
Most kids, you look at like Brad Pitt's career, any of these major stars, like they've been doing it for 10 years before like they really get those major IMDb credits, you know? And so my thought was, my brother's a business guy and he's always like, how do you make sure you're going to be able to make it? And I was like, you know, most people, there's a woman who is a producer for Grey's Anatomy, Krista Vernoff. And she has this article or this interview where she's talking about if we applied the same practices that med school students apply to our arts and our training, you know, it wouldn't be as hard of a conversation to have with your family. You know, like your family wouldn't be like, I don't know, your brother's going to school for medical to be a doctor. And my thought was 4 years of school. And then if I take all of the money I would have invested in, you know, grad school or med school or whatever else, and I invested that into my career and went ass broke and just did the work for as long as possible, it would be around the same time commitment and there, you know, less financial commitment. So that was my philosophy. It was like, just work your ass off, do as much as possible, try to catch up, mm-hmm. And enjoy it, you know? But yeah, I don't know, like it came easy, but it wasn't easy.
So what were those first opportunities like? So you get out of Illinois State, and I really like that idea of instead of thinking of it as something not like, I mean, going to grad school, people, when people go to grad school, it's like, oh, wow, so smart, you know, good for you. Go into med school. Oh, wow, for so smart. So why, you know, why not just apply that to the arts? Because the arts take just as much work. Yeah. It's just a different part of your brain. It's a different part of one's personality. Mm-hmm. So you get out of ISU. What are those first steps that you take into this world?
Yeah, so first was not finishing my degree.
That's a good first step. Step one.
I was a senior and the same practice. I put in all of this time and effort into that, right? I took my stagecraft class, my lighting class, my makeup classes, all the electives that I could possibly take at ISU that were acting related. I did every opportunity in free stage and all these like student run productions, to the point where I was like, I wasn't really going to school, guys. Like, I was in a conservatory that I made, you know, for myself. And I didn't do my gen eds, you know, I just didn't do them, most of them. And when I started to try to do them my senior year, I was behind. You know, there's like, you had to take 3 more years worth of prerequisites just to graduate. And I was like, well, that's not going to happen. And I was in a relationship at the time, and it kind of ended on a sour note. And I was sitting in my room with my buddy, and we were drinking rum. It was like really stereotypically depressing. Yeah. You know what I mean? And we were watching Slings and Arrows. Have you guys ever seen that show?
Yes.
And it was the first time I had seen it, and I saw the guy that was dating my ex-girlfriend sword fighting in the little alleyway right outside, and I was like, I got to get out of here, or something bad is going to happen, you know? So I called my dad, who I hadn't, you know, my dad and I, we got along, but we didn't really see, we didn't have the same passions. My brother loved golf, loved Irish history, loved hurling, all this stuff. And I was like, you know, kid who brought a skateboard to a farm town in Ireland when he was growing up, you know, like a total jerk.
Come on.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was great. It taught me a lesson about how to hit the pavement, you know.
Yeah.
Hard.
Yeah. Oh,
man. Only way to
don't skateboard on gravel.
I can see that. I've got a content. My mom's side of the family is Irish Italian, so I can just picture you and like, I don't know. Just the middle of like, do you know where in Ireland?
Yeah, it's a little town called Newmarket, Cork.
Oh, in Cork. Yeah. Okay, my side of the family is from Mayo.
Oh yeah,
it's like imagine, and they're all serious country bumpkins. Like I love them. They're amazing. Some of the best people I've ever met in the world. But it's like you know, how do you get into town if the car's not there? You ride the donkey.
Yeah, or you know, wait on the side of the road for a hitchhike. Tractor to go by.
And you're like, hello there, young fella.
No. What you up to? No. Yeah, you're grinding all day. How about a cracker?
Yeah, how's the crack?
Good. It's good. Thank you. My godfather, Uncle Tony, he took me to a cattle auction when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And you think Irish people talk fast. And then you go to a cattle auction, and it's like, how does anybody understand what's for sale, how much, who this guy is? Yeah. Like, it was exhilarating and terrifying at the same time.
At the end of the day, someone just walks away with the cow. No one knows if it's been paid for. It's just...
Bessie's just going to a new home. Yeah. Who knows if it's going to be a good home either.
Well, I hope so for Bessie.
Yeah, for Bessie's sake. It's the first time I had unfiltered cream out there. You know.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So you had unfiltered cream and you rode skateboards on gravel.
Gravel hill, yeah.
And you collected a decent amount of scars, I'm assuming, for that.
Yeah, yeah. Emotional scars, mainly.
Mainly. But you were saying you talked to your dad.
Yeah, so I called my dad and I was like, hey, here's the situation. I've always wanted to go to New York to be an actor. I feel like that's the place where you go to figure out if you can make it. And we don't really know each other really well. Like, really well. We spent a lot of time together on vacations and going out there, but I'd love to come out there. Do I have a place to stay? And he was like, yep. So I booked a train ticket, as you do, because that's the only way to travel, in my opinion. You meet some really interesting people. There's
riding the rails.
Stay on the ground.
People take the train for a reason. It's usually because they either can't afford to drive out or they are not allowed on planes. You know?
Oh, wow.
Or they have anxiety, or they have this, or they have that. They want to play guitar like I did on the way out there, whatever it is. You know, you're going through your moment. Uh-huh. And so I went out there, and I got to know him for like a year and a half, 2 years. And the first thing I did was, I had heard so many stories of people graduating as an actor and then waiting 2 years to get an audition. I was like, what a waste of energy. You know, like you got all this inspiration inside of you. So I stopped at my buddy Gabe Swee's place in Washington, D.C., and he was working in theater, and I went to a Pete's Coffee or something.
Yeah.
And I spent 3 days just getting my shit together. You know, like, here's my Actors Access profile. Here's my resumes. Here's my all this. And I set up an audition for the first day that I got there. And it was terrible. I found the side the other day from it.
Oh, you know? No.
It was like two white nationalists go to hell and talk about their experience in hell. And it was just
what?
Terrible.
Jesus.
But you find, I mean, as an actor, you say yes to so much, and you're not really sure if any of it's going to be any good, or what the script is, or what this or what that is. And that was what I learned, was like, just do as much as you can. And so I had auditions every day. I don't know if any of them were any good. I did, the first major one was, I saw a listing for Michael Sullivan. My full name is Michael O'Sullivan, Michal, the Irish Gaelic version. And I submitted, and I was like, hey, I'm ready for my role. And it was with Bryn Mannion, who was a Pulitzer Prize nominee playwright the year before. And they did this play called Wake, and it was a beautiful three and a half hour play that they did at the Irish Heritage Center in New York. And I learned everything I needed to know about being an actor and what I wanted out of doing theater, which was like showing up and you're working on a script in interesting ways. You're not just trying to get it right and then solidifying that and moving on. Mm-hmm. You're trying to figure out what the story is and what the characters are and the relationships. And at the same time, you're not like foregoing your group vocal warm up and your group physical warm up and working as an actual ensemble. Mm-hmm. So to come from a place like Chicago and not even know that this existed yet, and then go to New York and have something like that teach me, was incredible.
And how long did you stay in New York for?
About a year and a half, and then I would go back and forth. So I felt like guilty that I didn't finish my degree, right? You know, like, oh, you gotta have a backup plan. Who cares if things are going well? And that was the worst decision I ever made. I went back and I failed miserably. And it was the first time I went into serious college debt, because it was like a last minute, like fear based decision.
Yeah,
got an apartment like an hour and a half, not an hour and a half, a mile and a half off campus, you know, and that was enough of a deterrent for me to go to school. So I just used that year to read and kind of develop a sense of myself and learn how to sit with myself in a room, mm-hmm. you know, by yourself.
Right. How important is that to being an actor? Because I know acting is a very empathetic and can be very difficult line of work. I mean, you're working with, you know, characters not just that you've helped develop in your own head, but some that are possibly ascribed to you, might be portraying someone. So being able to sit with yourself and understand who you are versus your characters, I mean, is that something that you have to do every time you approach a role?
It's everything, yeah. And you know that you're in a good place when, like for me, I know I'm in a good place with a role when I read the script and after the first pass, I'm journaling as the character. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not like fiction. It's like, this is how I relate to it, mm-hmm. but I'm writing in that first person and I'm understanding what it must have been like pre this scene to walk into that situation. And, you know, I think for me, that's how you personally bring anything to a role. That's what makes you different than you, and then you, and none of it's better or worse than the other person, but some of it's more personal and relatable and honest and vulnerable. And when you get to do that, when, you know, the stars align, and, you know, it's not always perfect either. No. You show up on set and you don't know what the hell you're doing sometimes.
Yeah.
And sometimes great work comes out of that. Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily know if I have a foolproof strategy on how to work yet, but hopefully one day.
Well, it's as you said, it's a very natural process for you. It's not something that you necessarily were taught. You came into it and you kind of honed the craft.
Totally. In school, they teach you like all of the, you know, theories and you use bits and pieces of it. I remember auditioning for Michael Howard Studios in New York because I didn't trust myself enough as an actor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this guy who used to work with like the group theater back in the day, you know, all the stuff you read about, Michael Howard, and it wasn't an audition. It was like you went into his office and you talked with him for an hour. And at the end of it, I could tell like I wasn't ready for this class.
No, you know? No.
It's all Broadway stars coming in and working on Chekhov on their nights off.
Oh, of course.
It was beautiful. And I left, and as I was leaving, I was like, have you heard this book called The Actor and the Target by Declan Donnellan? I'm reading it right now and I don't understand it. He was like, I haven't read it. And I will read it. And everybody says that, you know, everybody says, we'll get coffee. I'll read that.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'll be the first to tell you I won't. But he called me at 11:30 at night that night and was like, look, Mickey, I think, you know, I don't know if you're ready for the class, but I read the book.
Yeah.
Wow. That night.
Yeah, that night.
He read the whole thing.
Yeah, and the time that it took me to, you know, get depressed, take a train back to my dad's place, you know, he called me and I was about to go to sleep. He was like, you can come to the class if you want. And the first day it was this guy on Broadway. I was in the bathroom washing my hands and he was taking a crap, I think. But he was singing and he was singing a song that I saw the night before. It was from Next to Normal on Broadway. And I was like, that's who I'm in class with. And the way that they took their art very seriously, I remember a note was like, you're acting vertically and not horizontally, meaning that like they were doing an animal exercise and she went to go to the zoo and study a bird and she moved her arm and her eyebrows. And he's like, what about your toes? You know, you move anything in your whole body kind of, if you're, you know, releasing tension and whatever, if you're comfortable and relaxed, your whole body's involved in movement or in emotion or whatever. And he's like, you know, you gotta act vertically and not horizontally. So, you know, if you cry, if you laugh or whatever, you know, your whole body is involved in that. And to restrict that is to restrict, you know, an honest experience being captured. So,
and that sort of athleticism with acting is something that probably resonates with you.
Totally. I'm a very physical actor, maybe not as much on TV and film because I'm still figuring out what the limits of being on camera is.
Sure.
If you go see any of my plays, it kind of looks like I'm a maniac. I just did a play 2 years ago called DOA. It was noir. And I just got the shit kicked out of me for an hour and a half. It's based off an old noir film. A guy gets poisoned. He's got 24 hours to live. And he's got to figure out who killed him, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I broke a rib my first weekend. We had a new gun on stage. Uh-huh. And it had a bigger butt. And my foot slipped a little bit from my sweat on the floor. And it hit my rib and it cracked my rib. And we didn't have an understudy at the time. And so I was like, fuck. So I'll take a lot of Bayer back and and finish out the
just
run.
Wolf that down.
But I sweat. Like if I'm not sweating at the end of a run, I don't feel like I've given everything.
Wow.
So I have a question. It sounds like you have certainly passionate, but it sounds like your background is mostly in theater.
Yeah, that's where I started for sure.
What is it like transitioning from theater? It sounds like you also still do it a decent amount, but what is it like being on camera? What's the difference?
Intimacy, I think. You know, who knows, in 2 years I could come back in here and be like, guys, it was all wrong.
TV is where it is at.
And that's, you know, people, if you're an actor, a young actor, you're probably Googling how to act, you know?
Yeah.
So much misinformation out there. And like, so I do say that with a disclaimer that whatever I say about, you know, how I feel about the camera work or whatever is not always set in stone, you know, mm-hmm. take it with a grain of salt. Right. But intimacy is definitely number one. If you're able to be relaxed and have a conversation and really be personal about it, and the prep is different, right? Like mm-hmm. you show up on the day and you got to do it. You don't get your rehearsal for 3 weeks. You don't get to talk about it for an hour and a half. You got to bring something special, you know, not only to your audition, but then you bring whatever you did in that audition that got you that job onto set, and you don't get your, director conversation for an hour and a half beforehand. You just got to bring it. Mm-hmm. And you also are forced to make relationship faster. You know, in rehearsal, first 2 weeks of theater rehearsal, you're like getting to know one another and they become your family. Mm-hmm. And for something like The Shy, it was like, you know, I'm working in a kitchen. And I don't know if you guys have ever worked in a kitchen. I certainly have. For better or worse, you become family real fast. You know, you get nicknames and, you know, people, you know, where you stand in the kitchen real fast.
100%.
And you got to bring that the day one. You know, there has to be that initially. So there's no time to be standoffish and you know, insecure. It's like, let's work together. Let's be a family today, you know? So that's the main thing I've noticed, you know, is understanding where the camera is, how it's seeing the scene, how it's helping tell the story. And where, you know, what the shots are. The more that I, you know, I'm starting to get into filmmaking myself, and the more that I do that stuff, the more that I work on crews, the more I'm understanding how a light is set up. I was working with Sophia Bush on Chicago PD, mm-hmm. and I was like, you know, what is it? You know, she said something about a light, and I was like, how do you know that? Like, how do you know that light is hitting you in that way? And it's looking like that on the monitor 20 feet away. And she's like, I grew up, my dad was a photographer, so I did lights for them. And I was like, that's it. You know, any person who's any good at anything has just had so much time around it. that they understand the mechanics of it. And when you understand it from an engineering point of view, you know, like Stanislavski was an engineer who just wrote stuff down. Mm-hmm. You know, he tried things out and wrote down the results, and he wanted to figure out how to do that consistently. And so on camera, it's just like, work on a camera enough. You know, when you buy that camera for self-tapes as an actor, if you're not then keeping that camera up and, you know, writing something or practicing a different monologue or practicing a scene or whatever, then you're wasting your time and your resources, because you have a camera to get to know it. You know, you have to be as comfortable around a camera as you are around your scene partner. You know, you're not changing things because there's a camera all of a sudden, you know? Mm-hmm.
So that theory translates, like, the way that you approach theater. While it's different, I mean, you adapt to the situation, and, you know, added things like, you know, camera. Like, you now have a different sense of an observer.
Yeah.
So, but you still, those mechanicals, those engineering points, as you said, are still the same, and there's still a lot to that you can carry over into film or television.
Chicago's a beautiful place too, because there's a lot of intimate storefront. Black box theater.
Right.
And the way that I think about that is that, like, the audience is a camera that's, you know, 5 feet away from you. Mm-hmm. And so if you can act for every one of those audience members as if they are, their eyes are the monitor 5 inches from your face, then you could bring it down to a level of honesty and truth and performance level where you're not shouting at them. You're not, you know, doing any of these things. And you just get to let them in on that moment rather than force them to look at it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I find the transition from theater to, but I was doing this summer. I was doing Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity at Red Theater, at Straw Dog Theater up north. And at that same time, I was shooting The Chi. And one of them was a satirical take on a wrestling owner like Vince McMahon. Mm-hmm. And then I was going and taking that crazy energy and focusing it in like crazy for The Chi and Chef Dan. And just hoping that there wasn't too much, you know, bleeding over, you know, like that you weren't screwing it up big time.
But looking at The Chi, so this is your ongoing project, as it were. Yeah. It's on Showtime, and it's a pretty interesting undertaking, because I feel like more and more in media, Chicago is being recognized as a very important cultural focal point. Mm-hmm. And that's weird to say, because Chicago has always appeared in films like The Untouchables. I mean, one of the greatest. Yeah. It's so many different movies have taken place in Chicago, but we've gotten to this point where the personality of Chicago is moving away from Al Capone gangsters 20s to being a real Chicago, a very accurate representation of Chicago. So what's it like being part of the show? You're from, I mean, you said you grew up by Midway Airport. Yeah. You know what this is like.
Yeah.
So how do you bring that experience into the show?
You're yourself. You trust that, like, they hired you for a reason and that you're playing a role in that. But also, as an actor, you're such a small part of the whole process that you're like, you know, I'm not going in there and doing, like, laying on my heavy Chicago, you know, like.
It's not just Bill Swirsky super fans here.
Totally. You know? And they'll let you know, too. Like, they're good enough to be like, hey, we need more of this or we need less of this. But also, you know, it was shot here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It was shot by a woman who grew up, created by a woman who grew up in Chicago, went to school in Chicago, wrote by people in Chicago. And so they kind of did the work for you. All you had to do was kind of like accept the blessing, you know, and not try to screw it up. But to the emotional feeling of gratitude to be a part of a show like that, because the industry is changing and it's changing for the better. And it's more inclusive, and it's telling stories in a way that's not just, news headline worthy. Mm-hmm. You know, it is about people and examining their lives, and it's not the way that it's been done. And so some people, I think, you know, you're reading, people's takes on the show, and they're like, you know, for the first two episodes, three episodes, they're like, you know, we're not seeing enough of this or this or this. But Lena is such an incredible creator that she's setting things up so that she can tell honest, authentic stories. And you know, in the pilot, I just keep talking about this with friends. There's a save, you know, the save the cat?
Yeah.
Right? You do something redeemable in the first, like, 2 seconds of, you know, your show or whatever, and everybody loves your character. It's a protagonist. Everybody gets it. Uh-huh. And this is a huge spoiler for somebody who hasn't seen The Chi, so close your ears.
Turning my mic off.
There's a kid named Coogie who goes into this alley at night to take care of this dog that he knows in the backyard of a house that's, you know, either a gang house or a drug house or something, and takes care of this little dog, you know, feeds the dog, and then goes, another spoiler, and dies. And so you have a save the dog moment. But then the moment that, where you're like, I love this kid. He's a beautiful kid. You know what I mean? Like, I get that kid. I am that kid. Uh-huh. In my best moments, I am that kid. He dies, and you're left with this, like, haunting realization that, like, this is what happens. You know, people on the South Side, people anywhere, you know, Boston, any of these major cities that are, like, typically known for this violence, they're human beings that, you know, just fed their dog or fed, you know, or just had a conversation with their best friend at the, you know, neighborhood corner store or whatever. And so Lena Waithe is able to take, you know, what we all see in the national news about Chicago and then pull the camera way back and show all of Chicago. And the end there is just beautiful. So, like, as a Chicagoan, I'm just, like, learning, like, keeping my eyes and my ears to whatever they're doing and being like, what can I learn from this? Because they're actually leading change in this industry.
It's amazing.
It is. And to feel that comfortable on a set, most sets you don't feel that comfortable. I was just talking about this with my Uber driver. I was like, I walked onto that set and I've never been treated more like family than any other set I've been on, even independent sets and whatnot. And not to say that I've been treating bad on any of these shows.
Right.
But that's Chicago to me, is walking in and being like, hey, we're family now. We're all doing this together. And you're not only going to do well, but we're going to make sure that we're not treating you like shit and we're going to be inclusive in our storytelling. So it just feels like a blessing, man. I don't know, to work with storybook kind of stuff.
It's interesting. It's interesting to hear you talk about the show like that, because it does seem like there's like an ambition, maybe like a race to capture contemporary Chicago. You got, you know, Joe Swanberg's Easy. You've got the slew of Dick Wolf shows. You've got, and The Shy. Mm-hmm. And so
there's a new one on Comedy Central called Southside coming out.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So many.
So, and you've worked on a bunch. You've been on Chicago PD. You've played two different characters.
Yeah.
Is that right? Two different characters. I'm curious about that. But anyway, what is it like working on The Shy? And would you say that The Shy is capturing a side of Chicago that no one's ever seen before?
I've never seen it before.
Okay.
And you know, from my perspective, yeah. And it's trying to. You know what I mean? Like, you could say it all you want. Like, in every show, you know, Joe Swanberg's Easy. Like, I didn't grow up in that neighborhood. We're raising a kid in that neighborhood. And, like, it's true to that neighborhood, and it's true to that. But, like, what's most important, you know, we have Black Panther coming out recently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just saw a video of these two little kids, and they're sitting there, and they're like, that's me.
Yeah.
And that's me. And I realized I grew up, and I did that with, you know, every fucking movie out there. I became an actor because I realized that it was possible for me because I saw myself in everything. And then I realized that that is not true for so much of the population. And so to have this show about people of color on the South Side and just the South Side in general and saying, hey, you're represented. You're represented authentically. We're fighting for you. And Lena Waithe had an interview recently where she was like, I challenge myself to name every character somebody that I love and care about after somebody I love and care about. And so that, I mean, it's a tough thing. She's just got a TBS pilot called 20s that she's been working on for ages. Yep. She was on This Is Us. Oh, God.
I mean, she's on a tear.
I don't know how she does it.
Yeah.
But she's the realest human being I know. After the premiere in Los Angeles, she came out and said hi to every single person that's working on the show, knew everybody's names, had a history, wanted them to come and, you know, throw down and dance at the after party. And, like, that's Chicago. That's the person that's coming out of their, you know, non-equity theater who's, like, who knows their people and is inclusive to all of them. But, you know, she's fighting for authentic storytelling and about people who don't often get the chance to have their story told or to tell their story. And so it's certainly creating dialogue and making change for the better. We have a new showrunner for season two, Ayanna Davis, and another woman of color from Chicago. And so, you know, people talk a mean game out of the bars about how they're going to be a part of change and how they're going to lead change. And to do it at that level and had no apologies, and not they're necessary, but like just going and being themselves and doing the right things. I don't know, man. It feels weird. You know, it feels weird to be a part of that, especially as one of the only white guys on the show.
Sure.
You know, well, to feel that blessing and that privilege.
And it seems equitable from the story that's being told, because it's not about like saying, oh, we're going to cut out white folks because they don't need to be part of the story. I think Lena's being honest in that they just literally, percentage-wise, are a smaller part of this story.
Yeah. You ever take the Red Line South?
Yeah.
And it's get down there and you are the only, you know, like, this is one of the most segregated cities in the world.
Yeah. Right.
And it's apparent, and nobody tells that story, you know?
Well, and now we have the Shy to help tell that story very honestly. And what days of the week does that air on Showtime?
Yeah, that's on Sunday nights. 9 Central Time, I believe.
Fuck Game of Thrones.
Fuck Game of Thrones. I don't know when this is going to be released, but there's a code for Showtime, 30 days free, Lena. Is a badass and was like, here's my code. And so if you type in capital LENA at Showtime, you get a free 30 days. And that's only good till tomorrow night. I'll be back on the Shy tomorrow night. The 18th.
Yep.
Get on that if this has been released by then. If not, not
unfortunately, it'll be on this Monday. But the fact is that this is going to be on Sundays. If you have a Showtime subscription, watch this show. It is very much worth your time. If you're from Chicago, try give Showtime a shot. You know, I think this is going to be one that might be worth the subscription.
Let me hop on that real fast. So
yeah.
Showtime is also doing other incredible work. Like there was this huge thing. Have you guys seen the show SMILF or SMILF, whatever you want to call it?
No. I recognize the lead actor.
Frankie Shaw?
Yeah, Frankie Shaw.
Frankie Shaw is not only the lead actor, she's the creator, the writer, the showrunner, and was the director of the pilot. And she's like a perfect example of a hardworking genius of an actor. She created a short film for like $3,000 when she was in L.A. wanting to be more... see herself more in, you know, roles.
Uh-huh.
And it got picked up by Showtime. And Showtime's so awesome about being like, how are we going to help you tell your story? How are we going to help out? And recently, the governor or the mayor of Boston was like, this is a smotch on on Boston. She's like, hold on. Every movie about Boston is about the mob, about the Irish mob, about, you know.
Padded?
Yeah. And it's like gun violence. And she's like, you don't like my show because you think it's single mother I like to fuck. And it's like, no. This is about a single mother living in Boston who's trying her best to give her kid a good life, to give herself a good life, and to go through it. Rosie O'Donnell's amazing on this show.
Yeah.
And it's a great show. And I think, you know, Chicago's the same way. It's like, why do we want our city to be represented in an inauthentically violent way? Why?
Yeah.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't help. The nation has a pretty poor perception of Chicago outside looking in.
Well, especially, to bring in the recent horrible shooting in Florida, a lot of people, you know, the gun violence thing gets brought into the conversation, gun control, and people always point to Chicago. They're like, they have some of the strictest gun laws in the country. It doesn't stop anything. And I'm just like, I don't know. I'm pretty sure it stops a lot more than you would think. And also there is this national perception that of Chi-Rac, which, you know, it's a term with a lot of history, but I think it's been co-opted by a lot of people. And I don't mean to be a dickhead here, but like a lot of people in the white suburbs that want to believe that Naperville is the safest fucking place on earth. And, you know, and it really discounts these beautiful stories, these beautiful human stories that are happening every single day in Chicago that, you know, people just want to tell. And that maybe if you pay attention and you take a moment to see these people not as folks living in a perceived war zone, but folks living in a city, just getting by, doing,
going to the same places of work that you are,
right, exactly.
I mean? Like, hanging out with their neighbors the same way that you are, who have had, you know, a crush on a girl across the street, you know, whatever it is, you know, like we're just telling human stories, you know, like, and to be non-inclusive in that is a detriment to, you know, like stories about people of color told by people of color sell. Period.
Yeah. Even from a cynical business perspective,
right. Exactly.
Black Panther is going to be like a billion. I work at a movie theater, and last night I was working, you know, Black Panther premiere Friday.
Yep.
Oh my God, the amount of joy and the amount of fun that people were having, amount of great business it brought in. I work at a non-chain, totally independent, four-screen, tiny little theater, and it helped us out immensely because it spoke to our audience. Our audience is largely African-American. Yeah. So how great is it that they can now come to the movies and not feel like they're being, you know, suppressed in some sort of way? They can celebrate and watch this great movie.
And that's where it's at, too. Like, as a theater actor, is when you're doing a show where the audience is excited and celebrating something there. Like, I did the Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity, which is, you know, very... it's about a Puerto Rican wrestler who is just kind of being oppressed by a white system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doing that show for, you know, either at least a little bit of a woke audience was like, oh my God, you're alive. Thank God you're fucking alive. The audience is alive.
Yeah.
You know, because you go and do theater and people are like hushing each other and shushing each other. And it's like, no, I want you to, you know, boo and hiss and cheer and cry. And, you know, if some guy, you know, answers his phone, be like, can you turn it off?
Yeah.
And like, I think that we're pushing that celebration now and saying, like, you should celebrate the stories that are up here, or at least, you know, have a reaction to them.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong if there's a comedic moment, or if there's like a, you know, a shock and all that sort of thing. Like, if something funny happens in a movie or a play, like, laugh, man.
Right.
Enjoy it. Unless you really didn't think it was that funny, then don't laugh. It's totally fine.
It's a community. When you get into that theater, like, you have all chosen to see that movie together. Like, you have that in common.
Right.
You chose to spend and it's become increasingly more expensive, you know? Like, you know, you have to sneak into movies now.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
And you got to sneak in your own food as well.
Yep. Well, I mean, that's all changing too. And thank God the disruption of, you know, MoviePass. But they're just learning from the things that we're doing anyways. When I was growing up, you'd go see one movie and then you'd go see four other ones.
Yeah.
And that was when it was $5.50.
Yeah. And now it's, you know,
$13.
What? Yeah. I think the river, what was it, River East down the street? That's got to be at least $13.50, $14.
You can also treat yourself and spend $35 at the AMC Dine-In.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I just took my mom there and I was like, can I talk to the manager real fast?
Yeah.
What the fuck do you think you're doing here?
Listen, man, I work fucking hourly. Don't fuck with me.
Well, and like, I think that conversation does have to happen of like, hey, look, I want to be here. I want to come see your movies. I want to tweet about it. I want to, you know, and I want to be able to help a cinema house. So what's going on that, like, an actor that you guys are kind of profiting off of, any actor or filmmaker or creative person comes to see a movie, and that's an expense for them, sure, but you're not inviting us to come see. You know, you're not sitting there saying, like, you are a part of our success. Why don't you come in here on a discount? You know, like, we don't have much of a discount other than on, like, Tuesdays through the Union Plus, and thank God for Union Plus and all.
Yeah.
But, like, MoviePass did it. They worked out a deal.
Really?
I mean, they kind of worked out a deal, right? Like,
yeah.
You pay $9.95 a month or whatever.
Oh, I see.
And it's getting complicated, no doubt.
Yeah.
But, like,
because what are they doing? How are they making money off of it?
Right. Maybe MoviePass is like a mattress store. It's just a money laundering service.
those bastards.
Oh, no.
I have to ask, as an actor, we're in this point of a whole new media revolution. I feel like the last time that media got this, you know, strung up with something, it was when we went from film to digital.
Yeah.
And now we're in this world where, okay, so digital, now there's literally streaming platforms where you can watch virtually anything. I mean, I've got Filmstruck through Turner Classic Movies and the Criterion Collection.
Yeah.
I can watch movies that were made in like 1935.
Damn,
just
right.
For $10 a month. Mm-hmm. And so as an actor with more original programming going to Netflix and Hulu and things like that, what does that look like for you? Do you want to try to get on that Netflix game, get on the Hulu game?
I want to create.
Yeah.
And I want to be a part of people who are creating, you know. Connor and I were just talking downstairs about how, like, music has changed too, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now we have constant access to whatever we want personally. And, you know, like, nothing's better than a recommendation from somebody that you trust. You know, like, you should really check out this movie at this point in your life. You know,
right.
Like, I just had somebody pull me aside. I was like, you got to take a look at this movie. I know what you're going through. And just take a look at this one scene. And, you know, you watch it and you're like, not only do you have a better relationship with that person now, but you have, you know, a peek into, you know, cinema or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to get a going off on a fucking tangent. I do that a lot.
That's okay.
But like, I'm interested, and I listened to the Marissa Lessman podcast earlier, and she's awesome, and she has a very similar point of view that I do, and it's like, you know, I'm dying to work with her. Hey, Marissa, what's up? but that's a Chicago thing too, is that like I want to work with good people, and I want to work with people who want to create, and I'm not interested in creating perfect things. You know, I'm interested in getting better as a creator, and the only way to do that, in my opinion, is to create and work with people who are creating things regularly. You know, I talk with a lot of actors and creative people. I talk with people in general. Like, one of my good friends just got sick, like really sick, and the night before she found out, she was like, you know, we were talking about how I was creating some noir thing that I'm working on right now. And she's like, that's so great that you're doing that. And I was like, yeah, but I don't want to focus too much on it. I want to move on. I want to do another thing and another thing. Because I talked to too many people who die with their opus never being written. And it's because I think that there's so much behind, you know, well, you know, you're late at night, you're talking with your friend at the bar and you're like, I got this great idea. And it's the same idea you've had for 5 years. And you haven't done anything with it yet. And maybe there's too much pressure on it or whatever, but like, just create something small and stupid and, you know, and put it out there and get it out of the way. It was like the first audition in New York. It was like, just get it out of the way. Mm-hmm. Just do it.
Don't be afraid to embarrass yourself.
Totally. And learn from it. You know, one of the things that I loved about Lena Waithe was she was a producer on Sisterhood, mm-hmm. which just got dropped on Netflix.
Right.
What's up, Netflix?
Come on the show.
And she went on Twitter and was like, "Hey, what do you think? What's your opinion of this? You know, like, you know, is this a story that we're you know, give us your feedback."
Yeah,
and that's it too. You know, you can create all to your heart's content, but if you never listen to the reaction, then you're not really growing as a creator or an artist. You're not growing closer. You're not going to actually be more successful at, you know, developing an audience and then being close and intimate with them so that you can, you know, give them the thing that they need to watch on their, you know, dead wife's anniversary, third year anniversary, whatever it is, you know, like those intimate moments. And so, yeah, I want to be a part of that. I want to, you know, this was something I talked about during the Great Recession, right? Is that like, we're about to go through a period that hasn't happened since the Great Depression. And the way that we attached ourselves to film, silent film, and it was a revolution. People went to stories so that they can leave their story behind and they can see themselves up there and they can find hope and find whatever. And that's what we're doing it now. You know, I forget what company just invested like $200 million or billion dollars into short form content. And like, yeah, you could be a businessman about that and be like, I want to, you know, be a part of that profit scheme.
Yeah.
Right.
Or you could just say like, you're giving us permission to create, you know, I think about all these like awesome web series. I just met Sam Bailey. Do you guys know Sam Bailey?
Sam Bailey. We haven't gotten to meet them, unfortunately, but I know Brown Girls.
Yeah.
Just picked up by HBO.
Yeah. Right. From Open TV.
Yeah, Open TV. I've gotten to talk to, we've talked to Amar Christian.
Yeah.
Talked to the folks from Afternoon Snatch on their OTV, but yeah.
Bobby and Iza, you know, they did the CISO thing through NBC.
Yep.
You know, like, it's all there. Right? It's like, I'm looking at my phone right now. I'm like, I could show you, you know, 25 things. When I was in college, I loved Derek Comedy. Do you guys remember Derek Comedy?
Oh, yeah,
I mean, of course.
What's collegehumor.com.
Derek Comedy is, why can't, Childish Gambino.
It's Donald Glover. Yeah.
And, what's her name from, Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, yeah.
She was the blowjob girl.
Oh, yeah. She was the sandpaper.
Hell yeah. I'm going to make it so dry for you. Like, she was so funny, you know?
But that, like, was a great, yeah.
Go back and look at those videos, and they're not perfect. They're not, you know, but they're funny, they're authentic, and they kept doing them. Mm-hmm. And it did, you know, you can reverse engineer it and say, like, and that's how they got to that level. Or you could just say, like, they just wanted to create, they weren't too worried about it, you know, like, I'm currently working on developing a content generation team, a think tank for content, but
sure.
People who aren't just the thinkers, who, you know, are multi-hyphenates, who can also then put those into practice and turn them around in one day.
Do and make,
and, you know, we're not talking about like a crazy pre-production. We're talking about sitting around on Monday morning and, you know, by Monday at 11:30, five ideas are on the table and you've got 5 hours to do them. Just do them.
Yeah.
Do them and put them out there. solve problems with content. Sure, whatever you know, get be a part of a conversation. Mm-hmm. Every morning, there's things that are trending on Twitter. Like if you're not creating based off of that, you're losing like a really important, generation, inspiration generation.
Opportunity.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you ever fear you're doing too much?
No. No. I'm not doing enough. I was talking with my friend. Right now, I'm actually doing less than what I was doing right when I first started out. Uh-huh. Because these projects, you know, like you have an availability now and you can't do certain things. But like I'm always, you know, I'm working on a short film coming up on the 5th of March. I am working on a feature film that's going to shoot on the 12th through the 30th of next month. And I'm going away for that whole time to shoot. I'm doing whatever I can to keep working because I have the time, and I specifically like made a decision a while back. Like, you know, I lived in my Jeep, right? Like I ate tuna and quinoa because that was the only thing I could afford. And I was like, I'm going to do this. I don't, you know, I've gotten fired from way too many jobs to then at this point be like, whatever is going to come my way, you know, like, no, I'm going to get out there and hustle. And I'm going to keep creating on my own. I'm working on a noir series, like I said, I want to write, and I want to direct, and I want to produce, what's his name? He's the guy who does everything. He's at 25 degrees from different places. James Franco.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
And there's something that I like about that is that, like, why not do everything?
Right.
Why not?
You know, multi-hyphenate.
Like, you don't have to be good at it, and you'll only get better if you do more. But to have an interest in those things is only going to make you a better actor, in my opinion. Like,
right.
If you know how a director's brain works and what pre-production means to them, then you're going to be golden, and you're going to meet more people and learn from their stories and so on and so forth. You know, I was just somebody just got accepted into Steppenwolf School of their ensemble, Celeste Cooper, who's an awesome Chicago actress, and I had worked as an extra with her on like a Skittles commercial like a year ago, you know. And, you know, those are the people that go through my mind when I'm creating, when I've got those stories, concepts, are the people that I've worked with before in Chicago. And, you know, I don't know that I have the time right now to be like, block everything else out. We're going to shoot this one thing. But I've become aware of the fact that it's possible to shoot it in one day, get it done, and not have it look like total crap, and to be able to, you know, leave it behind almost like an improviser leaves a scene behind. You don't, you know, think about it for 50 hours after that scene. You let it go. It was precious at the moment. It's not precious anymore. It's your baby. You toss it to the side.
Nah.
Take care of my baby.
Kill your darlings.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
All right, Mickey, thank you so much.
No, that was great. I mean,
you're a wealth of stories, a wealth of information, a wealth of, just thought on not just the process of acting, but the process of being a creative person. And we really appreciate you coming on the show. Again, you can catch Mickey on The Shy. That's on Showtime Sundays. And you said it's picked up for your season two?
Season two.
All right. Picked up for season two. Season one is currently ongoing, but you've got plenty more great Mickey O'Sullivan and so many more coming your way. Thank you so much again, Mickey. Let us know anytime you want to come back.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Chicago. And come on, Blackhawks. Let's go. Come on.
Go Hawks.
Let's go.
Says the guy in the Oilers hat.
Oh, that's a story. Hold on. I wore this hat because my brother, I stole a lot of clothes from him. I got to justify this. I'm in a Blackhawks commercial here. So.
Yeah, go for it.
We'll just do a slow fade out.
Yeah, right. Blah, 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 blah. my brother, I stole all of his clothes as a kid, and I stretched him out, and I bought this Edmonton Oiler hat for him because he's a traitor. And then I realized that it's not fair unless I actually wear the hat for a while and stretch it out and wear it in so that he knows when he wears it that it's actually my gift to him.
You should charge him like a vintage cost because it's totally, worn. It's like totally, a worn hat.
Yeah, now you got to buy me beer for a month, dude.
All right, this is No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we will see you all next week.